Before we get started, if you like the content you're listening to, feel free to send me a donation to support your favorite podcast. There is a link in the description below. And if you're interested in a life reading or intuitive coaching session, all my contact information is also in each episode description. Now let's join the podcast already in progress. You're listening to the Metaphysical Mentor Podcast with Michael Philpott, providing you inspiration, information, knowledge, and motivation to help you on your soul's path. Covering topics related to health and happiness from the mystical to the metaphysical and everything in between. Making the unknown known. Now let's join the podcast to discover today's topic. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in today to this show, the Metaphysical Mentor Podcast, with me, your host, Michael Philpott, and I'm really excited about this show. But I say that about all my shows because I just really love the people who come on. I love the information that is talked about. I love inspirational stories. And it's just, it really gives me goosebumps and I really enjoy this job. So it's just, and I get to meet amazing people. Like literally, I get to meet people from around the world. I have met, Ginny, I have to tell you this. I've met more people in the last 2 years and then I almost think in a lifetime. I've met so many people from just being on the podcast and reaching out and from all different types of things. So I'm really happy that you're on the show. But before we get down the rabbit hole, Ginny, I just have to say a little shout out to everybody who is listening. I do appreciate you guys, everybody that's listening. All my brothers and sisters down in the US, I love you guys. You know, you're big supporters of my show. And then of course, my peeps up here in Canada, got to say shout out to you guys. And then everybody in the Europe and Australia, UK, all those great places. And if I forget somebody, I apologize, but I do appreciate everybody that's doing that. So Ginny, thank you for being on the show. And I'm really pumped. We're going to talk about a few things. Like I always say that we're going to talk about one subject. I always kind of write down, oh, we're going to talk about one subject, but I think what's going to happen is we may talk about a bajillion different topics. We may go off on a tangent, which we always do. And for all those who are listening, I tend to go off on a little bit, not a tangent as far as what, just kind of deviate from the corrected plan that we have for the podcast. So, but I hear some really interesting things that you had a near-death experience. And that was, I really got my ears perked up because I find that so fascinating. So how did that start out with you?
Well, I've had technically two near-death experiences.
So two.
And then two remarkable experiences. And it depends how esoteric our perspective is, as that one might have, how you would define the other two experiences. So we can go anywhere you want to go. My first.
Go anywhere. Listen, this is one of the great things about the show. We can go as far as woo-woo as you want. We can go grounded, but I like a little mixture of everything. So just tell your story. I think it's just fantastic.
All right. Well, please put your hand up or something if you want me to stop, because I might not take a breath for an hour.
That's okay. I got my beverage here, so I'm just going to just sip away and just, okay, you got the next half hour. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Well, my first near-death experience happened when I was 3 months old. And wow. I contracted whooping cough. It was an out clause in my life plan. Things weren't going right. I could exit at that point. And that experience was one that people describe as going into the void, the oneness, the velvety black space. And I heard a voice. I did not see a being or anyone. I heard a voice, which I understood to be creator, God, source, whatever your language is. And I went home basically, and I said, no, I cannot do this. This is going to be very difficult, a lot of trauma, a lot of abuse, every way imaginable. I'm not strong enough. I cannot handle this life. And went back and forth with the voice creator 7 or 8 times. And he kept saying, I heard it as a male voice. So I refer to creator source as a masculine energy. And he just kept saying, I'm sending you back. There's something important you have to do. I'm sending you back. And about the 8th time, I was hysterical. No, don't make me go. You'd have no idea. I won't survive. It's going to be very difficult. And he said to me, I will make you stronger so that you survive. Wow. And I was back in my body.
Well, now I'm just going to interrupt you there. So basically, let me just paraphrase that. So at 3 months old, you exited your body. Now, a lot of people think, well, how does a 3 month old remember this? But your consciousness is not 3 months old. Your consciousness is infinite. So I was like thinking, like, how are you going to remember this stuff as a, you know, you kind of go through the veil forgetfulness. You pop back out like at 3 months and kind of say, okay, I'm done with this place already. And the thing is, did you have a recognition prior to this? Because obviously you knew that you signed up for all this crazy lifestyle. And I think a lot of us who go through these journeys, you know, if we knew what we knew, I think we'd go back too as well. We wouldn't want to be here anyways. But at 3 months, right, you decided like, okay, I'm not, but they're going to make you stronger. So from there, you come back, then what happens?
Well, I lived my life and I was quite traumatized, and I did not remember that near-death experience throughout my life until 2018, which is 6 years after my second official near-death experience. I remembered that through a spontaneous somatic experience. So I was laying on a massage table, having a massage from a woman who's an intuitive healer and also a massage therapist. And I had my face in the cradle, face down, and she was standing at my head with her hands on my back, looking toward my feet. And I said, I'm seeing an infant, a very small baby. Why am I seeing an infant? And in that moment, I was projected into the space and I experienced very viscerally that memory. And this was in the spring of 2018 when it happened.
Okay. And sorry to interrupt. So this was after your near-death experience or prior to your near-death experience?
So my second near-death experience was in 2012. So this is 6 years after. Okay. After I had been on an aggressive healing seeking journey. Very aggressive.
Okay. So basically you basically had three almost. Is that correct?
Four, technically.
Four.
Oh, yeah. Four? I mean, not technically, because in this life, it's a long story, I'll tell you.
Well, we got time. Don't worry.
We've got time.
Yeah.
So in that massage, intuitive healing environment, I had this somatic experience. The woman's hands were at the back of my heart chakra, right? The back of my heart chakra. So I was hysterical. I was screaming and crying. And I don't remember ever being so hysterical in my life since I was a child.
Wow.
I was crying. And the woman, she was crying, and I could feel her tears dripping down on the back of my head, drip, drip,
wow,
drip, while I was going through it. It
was intense.
It was really intense, incredibly emotional. And it was after that I realized I knew there was something out of balance, and I had been seeking for a long time. And yes, I'm telling the story a little bit out of order, but I had been wondering what was at the core. Why was I quick to anger throughout my life? And it became very clear after that experience that I was angry at God. I was angry at God for sending me back and making me do the life.
Yeah, I've had that issue. And it's like, why am I so angry? And hours of therapy that certainly helped. But yeah, I understand that anger. And that's really amazing, because I've heard stories similar to people having those type of cathartic releases and those really intense, you know, those somatic releases, or, you know, those interconnected things where they're having massage and when their body was lagging, and then especially if the massage person does energy work, like basically you just kind of shoot out of your body, like, and all that different thing, but the recognition at that time. So this, now you had the experience, but you also have had other, you know, near-death experiences too as well. So let's talk about those, because you're a lot older now. So obviously, you know, 6 years later, 2012 and then 2016, correct?
Right. Now, I had two pretty remarkable experiences in the 90s.
Oh, the 90s.
Prior to that. So if you'd like to do them in order.
Sure. Let's do it. Yeah. Let's kind of go through it, because, you know, I always love, because each one, you know, most people have one and then that just changes them. But to have multiple ones, that is really, that is really important. I think, and really just important, but also just, it's just crazy to think about it. Like just like one, right. People have one and done, and that changes their whole life. But now you've had four.
Right. And we don't know or understand the effect that they have on our life and the effect that going through the veil and, you know, having that experience brings to us. It activates our DNA, it activates our psychic senses. And oftentimes when we're not ready, we're not healed enough. But these two experiences that I'm going to share next are experiences that want, if a person believes in timelines, that we create different timelines in our current life experience where we have different outcomes based on different choices that we make, that's the type of experience I'm talking about here. So it was roughly 94-ish, 1994. I had had two children by that time. I was married. I was riding on the back of a motorcycle. So I was a passenger on a motorcycle in Los Angeles on the Marina Freeway, just in Marina Del Rey. And we were going about, I don't know, somewhere between 85, 95 miles an hour in the fast lane car. You know, in LA, cars drive fast. That's normal, right? And I was holding, my hands were clasped around the driver's waist. The driver was a friend of my husband, friend of our family. And it felt as if someone grabbed my hand, and I whipped around and I was pointing in the other direction, looking at the windshield of the oncoming very large sedan. And I thought, that's where I'm going to die. And my arm was whipping in the turbulence, and my other hand had nothing to hold on to because the man was wearing this giant leather jacket. There wasn't anything to grasp onto. And I could feel my other hand falling off, losing my grip. And my bottom was coming off of the seat of the motorcycle. So I was sort of flying through the air. My bottom had come off the seat. I was just whipping in the turbulence, violently being thrashed around. And what I can only describe as the invisible hand of God came out of nowhere and very forcefully propelled me back onto the motorcycle. And my hand whipped back around the driver, and I was able to clasp my hands again.
Wow. I love that. And I've heard so many parallel stories similar to that where spirit, now this is the crazy thing. People don't understand that spirit can manipulate matter on this plane. Like it's pretty freaky. And I've heard so many stories like that where they've had come into an accident and, you know, they've moved the vehicle. They don't know how they moved the vehicle out of the way. Or they, like you said, like they basically you're falling off and some energy puts you right back in your spot. You know, you're going for a ride and you can see it happening, but spirit says, no, you're not exiting at this time. And they will make sure that you've changed that exit time. And I just find that so, so incredibly fascinating because every time I hear that, I always get goosebumps. I just think, but then I get kind of freaked out, to be honest with you. It's like, if they're manipulating matter, maybe can they manipulate my bank account too, as well? I could use a little help on that too.
Right.
So, well, yeah.
So in that experience, my understanding is another timeline existed for me where I died, where I passed away. And there was a completely different outcome, obviously, for my family, my husband, my children. In this timeline, my soul went to the other side and talked to Creator again while I was flying through the air. And I've had this confirmed by just a number of, you know, psychics and intuitives and Akashic Records readings and all of that. And I communicated with Creator and I said, here I come, I'm coming back. I told you, you know. And once again, he said, no, there's something important you have to do. I'm sending you back.
Yeah.
And so that is what happened in this timeline. I was sent back again.
Wow. That's, I just love, so I think that's just so amazing. So, okay. So that was the earlier one, right? So now you go back, let's go to 2016. Is that correct? The new one? The latest one.
About 1998, my husband and I had moved to Lake Arrowhead out of the LA area and into the mountains in the Inland Empire. And I was driving my car in the fast lane on the 10 freeway headed toward Los Angeles. I had just come down from the mountain and my husband called me, and I was very energetically sensitive my entire life. And he said to me, he just blurted out, "I have a certain condition and I have to have a surgery." It wasn't horrific, but to me, it was, you know, something that would make me pass out. I didn't know at the time. Before, if I saw someone with a cast on their elbow, I would feel the pain. Or if I saw someone with a broken leg, I would feel the pain. Or if someone passed away, I would feel someone's grief. But this made me actually pass out. And I was in the fast lane on a completely jam-packed freeway traveling about 80, 85 miles an hour. And this was just when small cell phones just came out, you know, and everybody answered their phone, and that's what it was. And yeah. I answered my phone because I had two children at the time, and I left the mountain and they were on the mountain. So I answered the phone and he told me that he needed surgery, and I passed out and my vision started narrowing and I could feel the phone drop out of my hand and I could feel myself slump in my seat as I was trying to figure out how I could accelerate and navigate through traffic to get off the freeway if at all possible. But my vision was, what I literally saw in my memory was, semi truck after semi truck after semi truck stacked up to the right of me. And there was no way I could have accelerated to get to the side of the road. And what happened was 20 minutes later, I woke up in my car in a McDonald's parking lot and picked up the phone from the wheel well and called my husband, and roughly 20 minutes had passed. And he said, "What happened?" And I said, "Well, I died, but I'm here. I can't explain it." And I had a memory of my car sort of flipping in between the median and the semi truck and flipping over the center divider and having some horrific accident with, you know, 50 cars and a lot of death and destruction. And I said, "I can't explain it, but I died." And so he was about 100 miles away in Los Angeles. He drove 100 miles to where I was, picked me up, drove me back into Los Angeles to a doctor there. We had just relocated, so all of our doctors were still on the west side.
Yeah.
Took me to a doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, you're fine now. You're just sensitive. You have something called vasovagal. You just have to be careful. You're fine. I'm sending you home." So then he drove me 100 miles an hour back to my car, and he had to drive back to LA then, and I just went home. But again, I've worked with many, you know, mediums, psychics, et cetera. And literally people see a hand reaching down and picking up my car and moving it from the freeway into the McDonald's parking lot, which was off the off-ramp that I was just driving by.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really, really cool. I mean, that's, you know, when you hear about miracles, you hear about spirit, you know, interfering, and they don't do it too often. Like, that's the funny thing, because it's kind of hands-off. I know a lot of, you know, guardian angels, you know, they make sure that we're safe and stuff like that, you know, but you have an exit time, you have an exit time. Unless the peeps up above, you know, it's like a corporation, unless the CEO says, "Oh, we're not going to fire this person, we're going to keep this person." You know, it's almost like that same way on the other side in some ways. And that's really interesting. So you had that experience. Now, what was you got one more?
Yes. And a literal near-death experience. So at that time, my job, and this, I just really want to say, this makes me think of Amy Bedreau, who you recently interviewed.
Yeah, Amy.
So
yeah.
I was technically an executive protection agent. I protected foreign diplomats on unofficial state visits in the U.S. So I carried a gun for a living. I had a concealed weapons permit in the state of California, which is very rare and extraordinarily rare for a woman.
Yeah.
And I was in a job where when you agree to work on a detail, you work every day for a minimum of 90 days. There are no vacations. There's no time off. You work 14 to 16 hours a day. You exercise every day. You're in very high threat environment. You're listening to threat assessments and information about what's going on in the world and what are the credible threats to your protectee every day. And you're bomb checking cars and you're in a hypervigilant state. And so I did that. I trained for the job for 3 years prior, and then I did the job for 3 years. And in 2001, I became quite ill. Imagine that, right?
Yeah, go
figure. I wasn't able to, chronic fatigue and pain, and I couldn't exercise every day, and my shooting scores were going down. And that really bothered me because I was a competition shooter, you know, and that was really important to me. Also keeping up with the men, all the men that I worked with were former Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Delta Forces, men that carried the football, literally who stood at the door of the White House or Marine One. I worked with some amazing, incredible men who, you know, I was 5'2", weighed 105 pounds. They were 6'3", weighed 260 pounds. And they were all running the stairs in the Colosseums and all the towns that we went to and cities we visited. And we went to some pretty remarkable places, and it was just a competition constantly. Who could do more pull-ups, push-ups, sit-ups, you know, everything.
Of course, yeah.
And as a woman, you can't say, oh, I'm not, you know, feeling well today. Then, you know, they'd make a joke about you, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, I put my tough girl panties on and I did it, you know. But my body finally said no. And yeah. So I did medically retire early in 2001. And the first time I went to the doctor, Michael, you can probably guess what I'm going to say next. The doctor tried to hand me a prescription for narcotics.
Wow. That's, you know, that's a typical thing, right? It's like, here, yeah. here's your pharmacy. Here you go. See, let me know if you get any worse.
Right. And I said, no, whoa, no. And this, every doctor I ever went to said, you refused medication. So I said, yeah, well, I carried a gun. I didn't want to lose my license. I didn't want to lose my certification. I love my job. I wanted to go back to work. I got to travel. You know, everybody else took care of all my responsibilities in my life. It was a wonderful escape. And I got to travel and make a lot of money. And, you know, that really floated my boat at that time.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to take the drugs. And for 7 years, I mostly refused. I mean, of course, at a certain point, I accepted a prescription for narcotics, like 5 milligrams of hydrocodone or something. And I took it and it made me fall asleep, but it never made the pain go away.
Oh, wow.
Because the pain was emotional. The pain was trauma. The pain was my nervous system telling me I had unprocessed memories, but I didn't know that. And I never read a self-help book in my life, and I majored in economics, and I never heard the word spirituality, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so true. You know, that's, and it's amazing how much your body goes through in a hypervigilant state all the time. And that's, you know, people who have illnesses, even at a young age, like if you have hypervigilance and, you know, a hypoarousal state, because you're in that sort of thing, that it's a, basically like PTSD, and you just don't realize the damage that it over long term could have on you. Yeah. It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, the body can tolerate a lot. It's amazing how much we can tolerate, but there is an end point depending on the individual. You know, sometimes the body was going to say, yeah, forget this. And then it's going to send you all these information and all these illnesses and things start showing up that you can't believe that you're having. And it's like, what's going on? Like, obviously something's wrong. I need to figure this out. Wow. So you had the narcotics. Now, was that, now I read it a little bit in your bio. Was that, that caused your last one, wasn't it? The narcotics that actually caused the near-death experience. Was that correct?
Well, I mostly refused narcotics because they didn't help the pain until about 2007, 2008, when my doctor handed me a fentanyl lollipop and said, this is your only hope.
What?
And so I began taking the fentanyl, and 4 years later, the fentanyl caused my brain to forget to tell my lungs to breathe.
Wow. That's, I mean, I've heard the like crazy stories about opioids and fentanyl, especially. I mean, there's such a huge rise in fentanyl deaths, you know, especially in our country too, as well. And a few other places, but wow, they actually gave you fentanyl. I just said, okay, this here, we can't do anything. Let's just give you some fentanyl. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, 7 or 8 years of really trying. I mean, they misdiagnosed me with 5 or 6 things. They had me on every non-narcotic prescription one could be on, including methotrexate, which really degraded the quality of my life and my condition even further. It's a low dose oral chemotherapy. So, yeah, I mean, I did try everything, and my doctor did try everything. He was on several boards of several rheumatological societies for different diseases, and he worked at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Beverly Hills. I mean, this was a respected doctor who wasn't handing out fentanyl lollipops like candy. This was literally 7 and 8 years of constant testing and constant driving into Los Angeles and sharing my symptoms, and, you know, nothing was working.
Yeah. Wow. So after that, you're basically, your brain shuts down, your lungs, you can't breathe. You have the latest near death experience. So what happens then there? So do you actually transition out of your body and go to the other side? Is that what happened?
Yes, I didn't have a complete, what people refer to as a, by definition, if you meet 5 or 7 points of these certain things happen to you, this is a, you know, legitimately a near-death experience. I don't know who made up those rules. Well, I actually do know the people because I've met them because I've spoken at all those conferences and done a lot of that type of thing. But I went to an in-between space is the best way I can describe it. I was propelled out of my body. My heart stopped. There was no air in my lungs. I was in an in-between space, and the being that I saw revealed itself to me as Jesus, as the Western white model of Jesus, because that's what gave me comfort. I was raised Methodist. So the being, whomever it was, whether it was myself or another aspect of my soul or a guide, appeared to me as Jesus. And he gave me, I was being given a choice, basically. And he said, you know, you have suffered enough. Would you like to come with me? And I thought, well, yeah, I'm on a lot of medication. This makes sense. I'm dead. Yeah, it's time to go. And I thought better of it. I thought, well, who will take care of my husband? Which was silly because my husband was bringing me 3 meals a day in bed, which is how, you know, non-functioning I was at the time. And then I heard a noise behind me and I turned around and it was horses. There were about 20 horses and 70 donkeys, which is the number of horses and donkeys who were residents at a sanctuary that I volunteered at the last couple of years of my life. My husband and I were horse people. And I wasn't able to ride or train or really do anything with horses anymore. And we had to move off of our ranch and move into a city to be closer to doctors, to pain medicine doctors and that type of thing. So one of my horses had, who was unadoptable and unrideable, had to be placed in a sanctuary, and I couldn't just leave him there. I kept going back and volunteering, you know, as I was in decline, and I volunteered, and sometimes I would brush a horse or two, or maybe muck a stall or two. And at first I went, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, and then it was 3 or 4 days a week, and then it was 1 or 2 days a week, and then I had my near-death experience. And the commotion behind me made me turn around in my consciousness. And the horses and donkeys were screaming, "Don't go, don't go. Don't you remember there's something important you have to do?" And that triggered something within me unconsciously. And I turned around and looked at the man that looked like Jesus. And I said, "Sorry, Jesus, I'm going with them." And I was immediately back in my body and knew I had made a mistake. The pain was horrendous. My lungs were on fire. It felt like a 300-pound man was sitting on my chest. My heart had stopped. I'd had a few strokes from the, you know, oxygen deprivation or whatever was going on with that whole process. And it was horrific. I screamed 20 or 30 times at the top of my lungs. I just died. I just died. I just died. I just died. I was over and over just screaming that, and scared my husband just really terribly. And after that day, I realized I needed to get off of drugs if I was going to live. And that was really a very ironic thing for me to want to live, because I had been bedridden for so long. I thought I had something to do. I needed to do something. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know why I thought that I needed to live. And it, you know, the irony was just incredible, because I slept probably 15 or 16 hours a day and watched HGTV for the other few hours a day, you know. And so it really was nonsensical that I had such a passion to live and get off of opioids.
Wow. But I mean, it's always so amazing to people that do get off opioids, because it is such a struggle. It's such an addictive drug. And it's just, I mean, the idea behind it is the stop the pain, which is really important, but the long-term effects or even short-term effects of it is just, it can be really horrific. So you made that decision, you made that conscious decision to come back. You saw your animals, and, you know, animals can be really profound. I've had another friend of mine talk about the same experience where during meditation, it was her animals that spoke to her. And that's what really, you know, gave her the motivation to continue on and to start doing a healing journey more. And I just find it fascinating, you know, that it takes animals, not humans or even spirit guides. It just takes your animals to do the work to bring you back to reality, to set you on your healing path. So with your decision, stuff like that, did you start working with your horses right away? So I know you talk about horse medicine, like as part of your journey, and you actually do horse medicine, which is a really fantastic thing, because I've heard so many wonderful things about the magic and power of horses. Like literally they have some, like this, I don't want to call it magical powers, but you may call it that. But I just find it's just so interesting that why was it horses that started your journey?
Well, I didn't know that for about 6 years.
Yeah.
That information was not available to me until I went on my own healing journey as a human being and became more consciously aware. Immediately after my near-death experience, I developed all psychic senses and more than people discuss. I could see multidimensionally. Everything was consciousness to me. I could hear and see trauma in the nervous system. I knew where the unhealed wounds and unprocessed emotions were in people's chakras, in people's meridians, in their subtle bodies. But I had no context. I had no vocabulary. I had no experience with any of this. Wow. But because of what you just said, Michael, about it being difficult to come off of the medicine, I'd like to share my experience with my doctor. In immediately going to my doctor right after my near-death experience and asking him to lower my prescription and saying that I had a near-death experience and I didn't want to die and the medicine was going to kill me. Two things. One, my doctor said, nobody ever gets off of fentanyl. You'll just eventually die. I've had thousands of patients and only two have decreased their dosage a little bit. I've never had a patient get off of opioids. And I said, well, put my name at the list, top of a list, make a list and put my name at the top because I'll be your first one. So about a year and a half later, I came back and we had been reducing my medication against medical advice. And I did it by myself. And you are correct. It is one of the most difficult things. It's not for everybody. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. It was very difficult, very emotionally distressing, physically difficult. But I finally got off of the medication and I went back to him and I said, now, how do I get my body back? My muscles are atrophied. My tendons and ligaments are all dried up. My brain doesn't work. My memory doesn't work. My vocabulary, you know, you've noticed, I'm sure, a few times in this interview already, I start to speak and then I lose my place in my sentence and I have to stop and think and, like a hamster on a wheel, find which words do I want to use. So I do apologize for that, but that's just how I am.
Don't need to apologize for that. That's just part of your journey. It's part of who you are. And that in itself, just letting people know, understand that it's okay to talk about your situation, stuff like that. And that's why, you know, it really interests me about your story, because there are so many people who might be suffering right now. And just by listening to you go, oh my God, somebody did get off this. Somebody could, like, that little inspiration and hope is so magical, so powerful, that literally can change people's lives, just your story alone. So that's why, you know, don't apologize, no ways whatsoever, on how you speak and stuff like that. I have a speech impediment too as well. And that was just from, it wasn't from drugs, but it was actually from just abuse as a child, you know, learning to speak. So I get it. Don't ever apologize for that. I mean, it's something that you should just, you know, hey, this is who I am and that's it. And if anybody else doesn't like it, screw them. That's what I'd say. Forget them. Don't worry about it.
Thank you for that. Yeah. So what the doctor said to me, and I will never forget it. And I speak at medical conferences, chiropractic, naturopathic, osteopathic conferences as a keynote speaker. I often wrap up an event or speak on a Saturday night. And when they hear what the doctor said to me, they're horrified. So I said, okay, I'm off the drugs now. You know, how do I get my mind back? How do I get my memory back? My vocabulary? I can't sit at the computer and do any work. I mean, I majored in economics. I was a wonderful, gifted accountant, business person. I could debate corporate law. You know, I mean, just really intelligent person. And here I am, and I feel like just a noodle. You know, I'm just a noodle. And he said to me, and I quote, "There are no long-term studies on the effects of opioid abuse or use because nobody ever lives long enough to study them." And I said, well, here I am. The Mayo Clinic's just down the road. You want to do a study? And he just scoffed and laughed at me and said, what do you want from me? What can I do for you now?
That's a defeatist attitude. Oh my God. Well, but you know, I don't mean to laugh or jest, but it's just so comical how these people, like, it is, you almost have to laugh at these sort of situations, even though I hear this all the time from doctors. I've had my own crazy experiences with doctors. They tell you can't do this. And, you know, there's so many amazing healers out there that's proving us wrong. So I'm glad you proved them wrong. Hmm. You know, that's wow. Okay. Right. Sorry to interrupt you there, but I got to add my right. 2 cents in there a little bit.
No, absolutely. You know, and the evidence of it, you know, the left side of my face droops. I think I have my image mirrored, but this is the left side of my face. And so this eyebrow is lower, my eyes all squinty, you know, this side of my cheek. So, you know, I've had strokes. I've had, you know, things have happened. Of course. So after that, that's when... Well, I just woke up from my near-death experience in 2012. I could hear dead people. I could see dead people. Plants talk to me, you know, trees, plants, ants, cats, dogs, dead people's, you know, dead people, dead dogs in people's houses. And, you know, I'd be there looking at their white dog and I would say, well, who's the collie? And they'd be like, well, that was my dog that died when I was a little girl. I'm like, well, he's right there, you know, or people would talk. And what they were saying, what was coming out of their mouth was not what their heart was expressing, was not what their consciousness was intending or speaking. So I had some pretty interesting abilities and I went on an incredible journey that took me around the world to try to find out what was happening to me and to try to find some context. And I studied several of the world's primary religions, never to the master level, but to get a, you know, almost full body experience of it, because I wanted to understand. And everybody kept telling me they were right, everybody else was wrong, that I must be seeing wrong because I didn't fit into their box or their protocol or their paradigm. And they've been doing this for 40 years and they know what they're doing. And, you know, I'm invalidated at every turn. And I kept saying, no, there is such a visceral sense of truth for me in my claircognizance and my clairsentience that I know, I literally had a direct connection to my oversoul, to my, the Hindus call it the monad.
Yeah.
And I brought back such high frequencies every time I died. I wasn't healed. I didn't have my health problems corrected. I didn't have my trauma released. The whole purpose of my journey was to discover how a person can become self-aware and self-responsible and heal themselves through much greater understanding of consciousness than simple mindful techniques or yoga or breathing. That there's much more, we're much more complex than anyone, even psychologist or Carl Jung or Rupert Sheldrake, openly discuss. And so my purpose, eventually it was revealed to me after I was, went very far down the road on my own healing journey, was that I was supposed to bring this knowledge and level of understanding to the animal kingdom, because so many people deny animals themselves as sentient beings, and we are not honoring their souls, and we have them in domestication and domination and control, and we are not realizing that many of these animal souls have individuated away from the collective consciousness of animals. And they too have scarcity beliefs and trauma and unforgiveness. And so, some people say, if you're one step ahead of humanity and you're on the cutting edge, you're a genius. But if you're two steps ahead, sometimes people just think of you as a crackpot. And, that's pretty much my journey in a nutshell, is I was a little bit further out in, it was like I was a scout going over the mountain first. I wasn't the tip of the spear. I was a scout. And now, thankfully, people are willing to listen. Not a lot, but many people are.
Yeah. Well, I think, this is one of the things I even myself, I was a skeptic on a lot of different things, a lot of different subjects. And, I always thought, yeah, right. I always had that idea. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. I'm sure. But then as I opened up, my own spiritual gifts opened up, I couldn't start denying that. So how can I deny somebody else's gifts and also understanding? Because as I evolve, my understanding evolves, my experiences evolve. And so before, what I thought was woo-woo is just natural or just normal. What I thought was supernatural is not supernatural, and I look at it now as like, I call a lot of my friends, even like some of my students and stuff like that, like they're like super freaks. They have these super freaky abilities now. Before, I would just dismiss them, when I was younger. And of course I was just an arrogant ass back then. I didn't know shit, but now I just call them. It's like now the natural way is to be that super freak. So you're not ahead of the curve. You are leading the curve. You're leading the people out there as part of that journey. And that's what I loved about even doing this show, because I've learned so much. Like, I was like, never, this can't be right. But then I'll have an experience. And then it's like, okay, that makes sense. So your gifts opened up, after your experiences. I've heard that before, like they're like your psychic abilities just kind of exploded off the charts. Mm-hmm. So you're mainly, you say, are you a clairvoyant, you're a claircognizant, or you basically have all the clairs, throw in a little bit of mediumship and add a little sprinkle of something else. And that's what's going on with you right now?
Yes. And it took me a long time to understand my abilities. And it took me even longer to be able to control them and have what I consider to be ethical boundaries around what I'm willing to receive and what I'm willing to perceive. It was quite a journey and quite an education.
Yeah, I think that's happened to all of us, because when you start getting these gifts, there's not a lot of people. And thankfully now I've found some good teachers who've helped me navigate through the thing. And they're really, really grounded teachers. But that's, I think it's one of the quintessential problems with people on this path that have these psychic gifts. There's not a lot of people out there that who are really grounded and who won't take advantage of individuals because of these gifts. And you're kind of in the wind trying to figure it all out. I mean, that's why the self-help books, and there's there's thousands of self-help gurus out there writing books and all this different stuff. And not that that stuff is not good, but a lot of stuff, you got to read a book to figure it out. And there's no practical applications or somebody to help you out and say, okay, this is what's going on. I get it. This is what's happening. This is what you need to do, like to kind of figure it out. And then you use those practical applications in your practice or just, as you do the work yourself. But that's always so confusing time. That's such a confusing time. I know when my gifts opened up, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I've reached out to a few people and it's like, oh, you're going crazy. Actually, at one time, I actually thought I was batshit crazy. I was hearing voices and stuff like that. And would I tell anybody I was hearing voices? No, there's no way I was gonna get locked up, you know, because that's what you were told. Like, you start hearing voices, you know, that's when the doctors will start medicating you. So maybe you're schizophrenic. Now, granted, this is a really interesting thing. At the time, I didn't know, but there was a lot of mental health issues on my dad's side. So I was like, oh, is it genetic? Am I schizophrenic? Am I a manic depressive? And then that stuff starts happening. But it really, I mean, there could be a little bit, you know, a little manic, but, you know, for the most part, it wasn't really mental illness. It was just like, I was perceiving spirit and getting messages, you know, from people who have crossed over. So it's like, oh, that's what that is. So yeah, I fully understand you on those gifts. So what is, do you have one gift that stands out more than another?
The claircognizance, the just absolute knowing, the immediate communication from my higher self to me, the clear knowing, like something like, you know, this isn't true, but I'll just say, like, Michael, there's a 6-foot-tall pink elephant with purple ears in your room. I can't see it, but I know it's there and I can perfectly describe it.
Yeah. And that's what I love about, you know, claircognizance, but clairaudience, and, you know, even with the clairvoyancies, that you can see that mental thing, but also know, you just kind of know, you don't know how you know, you just know. And I remember that when I started opening up, I just knew things. I couldn't figure out how I knew them. I just knew they were going to happen. I just knew that was going to be it. And people would always say, yeah, sure, Mike, sure. They'd give me a little pat on the back. Yeah, sure, buddy. But I just knew stuff was going to happen, and they came out that way. And yeah, the whole thing, it was about control. That was one of the hard things, just learning the boundaries and control. And one of the things, I think I read a quote from you, and you talked about how, you know, on your healing journeys, never give away your power to the healer.
Yes.
And I thought that was, you know, I said, I love that, because I've done that myself. And I know a lot of people who are out there who are on their healing journey have given their power away to healers. And I, you know, been guilty of that. And I realized that that is part of developing your own boundaries. Like, I could be responsible for my health and use that person, well, not use, but I'll use them as a tool to help me on my journey, but not to give away my power as such. But I found that was so profound. Did it take you a long time to figure that out? Or is it just one of those things that after a while you kind of go, yeah, this is not right?
It took me a long time. I was several $100,000 into my healing journey.
Oh, wow.
Before I went to Australia and worked with a lovely Aboriginal woman who explained to me that all the information I had received up until then, which was about 2 years after my near-death experience, was useless if I didn't use it for forgiveness and healing myself and becoming more self-aware. And so my experience with the Aboriginal culture is what really propelled me on a true healing journey and a true journey of self-awareness and becoming getting a PhD in my own consciousness and my own emotional and psychological health and well-being. I want to just say, referring to something you just said earlier about, you know, healers in the industry, a lot of people are simply taking people's money, you know, promising them to be able to manifest or to open their gifts and abilities, but there is no accountability and responsibility in any of that. They're not understanding how and why the soul controls the opening of the psychic gifts and abilities. And there, people may have absolutely no discernment, no boundaries, no understanding of what to do with it, when to know whether they're really talking to a horse or not, or an entity, or if it's a dead person in the room. And so there are very few people out there who are doing it well and responsibly, truly,
yeah.
Truly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. And that's, you know, there should be a warning label on some people's information. You know, it's disheartening in a lot of ways to hear that sort of thing, because you want to hear and you want to expect the best in people. You expect them to know. Yeah. But yeah, there's so many fraudsters out there, but I just, you know, it's really about, you know, do your homework. Don't give your power away. Do some little bit of research, you know, ask for some recommendations and trust your gut. Like, if it seems a little off, like I always say, if somebody's basically asking you for 10 grand for a 2-week course, you know, and you're kind of like, wow, 10 grand like that. I mean, that's a lot of money right now. Like, you know, something that really, I mean, it could be well worth it, but I'm just saying it's something that's so, extravagant, you know, here's, give me $50,000 and I'll give you a scented candle and I'll take all the curses away from you or stuff like that. You know, those kind of things, you kind of just kind of perk your ears up a bit and kind of go, yeah, I don't know about that. But yeah, it's interesting. So you went to Australia to work with the Aboriginals. Now, was that your kind of like, what was that decision to kind of go to Australia to work with the Aboriginals? Now, were you working with Aboriginal people here in the, or in the United States too as well? Or did, was it first you started with the Aboriginals in Australia, and then did you just work with Aboriginal communities here in the US?
Thank you for asking that. I never get asked that question. The reason I went to Australia is because my soul told me the very first time I incarnated on Earth was in that area, in a very similar, in that ancient culture, and that I needed to go there to come full circle for my healing on this planet, for all of the lifetimes that I existed on this planet in multiple dimensions. Wow. So that's why I went. And it was by sheer chance that I just went by myself. I only knew a couple of people in Australia. I had a friend there that I had met over the internet in some sort of, you know, spiritual group. And he let me stay at his house for a couple of days in the near Melbourne. But then I traveled in, you know, the middle of the country and went to Ayers Rock by myself and stayed in the hostel there. And I went under the rope, you're not supposed to, and under this a crack in a rock, and I laid under there and I thought, oh, I'm going to get eaten by a spider. But I knew I had to lay on that ground beyond, and I know that it was inappropriate from that culture's perspective, but I knew that this was a past life for me and I had to reconnect on that sacred ground. And so that's what I did. Working with an actual living human, yeah, Aboriginal was a blessing and a surprise to me. And I met a woman there whose name was McGare. And she is the one that taught me a lot about understanding past lives and how we resolve past lives and how certain past lives have to do with others and our judgments and what really is at the heart, or what from her perspective was really at the heart of what people describe as karma. And how I could begin to use the information that I was given by so many psychics and mediums to help myself and heal myself. And that made me fascinated with the Aboriginal culture. And I read a couple of books on it, and it all rang very, very true to me. And that, again, put me sort of out in front of a lot when I came home, a lot of the other healers and psychics and people. And then what happened after that is my soul, every time I went to a healer, basically said to me, so you're here for a reason. You're here because you're not going to duplicate this kind of healing that you're experiencing right now. And here's why. And while I was with the healer, my soul would take me on a guided tour of other past lives where I used similar techniques or had similar life experiences to that healer, and how I misused energy or interfered with somebody's soul choices or healed inappropriately. And by healing other people, we do take on their stuff, their karma, when we're interfering, right? And so I have become an absolute purist, to the point where I do not begrudge anybody healing through these new healing modalities coming out, like med beds and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't begrudge anybody. We've all been through it on this planet, but I myself will most likely not take part in any of that. My soul has basically told me we are the only technology we will ever need, and you're going to be proof of it. And he basically took me, and again, I say he because his voice is very masculine, yeah, to me. And just on a guided tour of all the past lives through hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years on this planet, and then other planets, and how we got to this place, and how we misused, you know, genetic manipulation and crystal technology, and how religion got infiltrated. And he always tied it in to the healing modality I was working with, the healer who I had a soul agreement, you know, one way or the other, that person was going to teach me. And I was shown, you see why their healing isn't working. It was both something to do with the healer and something to do with me. Every time I left a healer, whatever the healer supposedly released came right back to me anyway. because I wasn't doing it in my power and in my awareness. And then eventually I did reconnect with an Aboriginal by the name of Steve Richards in Australia. And that was your original question. And he works and his group and community teach the lore, the Aboriginal lore, and they their healing and what they teach now has everything to do with attachment, with entanglement with other souls from other lifetimes. And they work in hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, prisons for the criminally insane, and you know, people who have been labeled schizophrenic or insane in for whatever reason. And he just basically disconnects them from another lifetime and or an entity or a demonic being, and the people are completely healed, completely cleared, because he's trying to demonstrate to people that, you know, 85 to 90% of our life is managed by our subconscious. And a lot of that is other consciousness attached to us or working through us in very interesting ways that you have to be willing to have in a very advanced esoteric perspective of our reality in order to accept. But I've seen it happen. That's the work that I do as well. And it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so amazing where like you have an attachment and something, and it's in your energy field, and you, and somebody like who's really talented at that and be able to pull it out, you know, bring it to the light, clear it out, remove the implant, whatever else it may be. And they're just like, it just automatically changes. And like, you just kind of feel so much like yourself, like you kind of walk away, go, what just happened? But there's always that point where you, like you say, sometimes that energy may just come back to you, and it's like, oh crap, you know, what's going on here? But yeah, it's so interesting. I've had that experience where, you know, somebody removed something that's attached to me. I was like, you got something attached to you. And I go, yeah, and go figure. I live in a city. Of course I'm going to have stuff attached to me. But no, she says, yeah, you do have something. And once it just feel like somebody pulling, you know, a hair out of the back of your head. That's what it felt like. Click. And then, you know, it was released and it was gone. I was like, I feel a little more relaxed, and I just, you can feel your body just shifting, and it's just amazing how that happens. But in the psychiatric world, I've heard so much of that because, you know, from my understanding, from some of the people I've talked to about energy healers, about the crown and the chakra being so open that they have so much stuff coming in, and all this, it's just like an open invitation to anything to come in through that vehicle, that space. Or even in the higher chakras too, as well. It's just that information, that all that stuff is just filtering through, and there's no filter, and everybody seems to get attached. And that the idea of hearing, you know, multiple voices, things happening, it's just because the crown is just gone wide open, and everybody, they're just a vehicle for things and entities to be around them. So I always thought that was a really interesting take on it. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So you work with the indigenous people. Like, what I always think it's so fascinating. And I always say to myself, you know, there's so much more we can do and learn from our indigenous cultures that we just haven't, you know, just haven't learned. And it's mm-hmm. such beautiful wisdom and information, like the Aborigines. And I think that's such a cool thing. I just think that's so fascinating. And their whole understanding of the universe. It's like, yeah, they know it. They fully understand. And we're still trying to figure it all out. And they've just, you know, handed down through generations and stuff like that. So one of the things I want to talk to you about is some of the modalities you use right now, because you do this, you know, you talk about, you know, this interspecies, you know, consciousness and connecting humans to animals, which I find really fascinating. So one of the things I've always wanted to ask you is like, why the animals? Why is it important that we have this interconnection to animals?
Well, there's so many ways to answer that question. And there are so many answers really to every question. And it depends on our perspective and our level of consciousness and, you know, sort of where we are. But it wasn't my idea to do this. My journey unfolded every day, much to my amazement. No one was more amazed than me. But I was asked by the animals that I am reminded that I had a soul agreement to share this information. And I think that ultimately, almost anyone probably that you've ever interviewed would say that it's imperative for us to begin to be aware first of ourselves as sentient beings, as infinite energetic beings, and what we are capable of, and understand our consciousness and our energy field. and then to expand that, not only to the planet we live on and the plant kingdom and the nature spirits, but to animals as well. And that animals bring with them, certainly from a totem or spirit animal perspective, which I think people greatly conflate with living animals in physical bodies, that living animals in physical bodies are also souls on a journey of evolution, and that they should be able to have a voice and a choice, and that there is a way for us to live in conscious partnership with the animal kingdom. And it's just as important as any other topic. You know, there are nearly 8 billion of us, and we all have different soul purposes. And some people, it's to live in, respect the earth and not dump toxins into our oceans, and to sustainably farm, and to not do, you know, slaughtering animals and, you know, in such a horrific way. And then there are other people whose job it is to reform government or reform education or reform, you know, the field of psychiatry or whatever it is. And they're all important. And I don't think any one of our perspectives or any one of our jobs is any less important than the other. We all are a puzzle piece in a very intricate puzzle at a time of great transition and confusion on the planet.
Yeah, that's so true. It's such a nutty place now. I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s, and I'm just thinking, okay, I thought that was crazy. And then through the 90s, but now it's like, what? But, you know, I know we're heading for a change where I know there's a lot of consciousness evolving, and systems have to get broken down. Things have to be exposed. And, you know, it's just an ugly period, but I know there's light at the end of the tunnel. I had a, you know, interesting conversation talking about the 2038 prophecies and how things are changing and developing and moving into a new higher consciousness, which, you know, I get kind of excited because I think I might be here by 2038. I might see this process happening, but we're kind of seeing it now. And you're so true. It's such a nutty place right now. I just shake my head sometimes. I go, oh, every time I turn on the television, it's like, oh, got to turn this crap off. I can't listen to this. But yeah, there's just so much we can learn, so much what we can learn from our animals and do that. So Jenny, I just have to let you know that we're almost out of time here.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been a fabulous conversation. I know you do a lot of work with animals. You do a lot with humans too, as well. For people who are looking for your services, they want to reach out to you. I know you have some great services that, you know, working with animals, but also with people too, as well. So if people are listening to this, they want to connect with you, they want to see what you're all about, where can they find you?
My primary website is heartofthehorse.us. And there's too much information available on that website. You know, so many people tell me that's not a modern website. You just need one landing page. And I say, oh my gosh, you have no idea the feedback I get, that people love to read the hundreds of testimonials, the stories, the personal stories, my story. And I try to provide a lot of information there. So if people are interested, I also even refer to other ethical, effective healers. You know, I really want people to be able to have many different experiences and to understand that no one of us have all the answers.
Yeah.
And the way I work is that I don't teach, I don't lecture from my life experience, I don't assume anything. I am here to hold a space and give messages from a person's energy field, their body, their consciousness, or their soul.
Yeah.
And I let them know what is their priority. What does their soul want them to know right now?
Yeah.
And that's how I work. And I'm able to perceive energy. And are you managing your own energy? If not, why? Are you grounding? So many people aren't grounded, and they go to psychics or healers and they tell people, well, what does it matter? You're connected to the earth. Don't worry about that. That's a person that is not self-aware.
Yeah.
You know, I'm brought in to talk to groups of, you know, who believe they are advanced spiritual people all the time. And the first thing I talk about is self-awareness, because they're not self-aware. And I'll go person to person and say, so what's happening when you're grounding? Oh, I go to ceremony and I call on angels and I do. And I'm like, okay, you didn't answer my question. What happens in your body and your energy field when you intend to ground? Because I'm seeing that you're not grounding. You're literally not connected energetically. You're not bringing earth energy up through the chakras in your feet. Oh, I didn't even know I had chakras in my feet, you know? And, so I think there's a lot of people out there who, you know, they get an ability or what have you, but then there's no self-awareness coupled with that. And that's where the danger is. So yeah. I try to help people become more self-aware and more self-responsible, even if it's a little slower than what most people promise.
Yeah, I love that. It's all about the self and self-responsibility. I'm a big fan of that. And I so appreciate you and your work that you've done that. So for those who are listening, I'll have Jenny's all the information in the description. So if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple or, you know, Anchor and any other platforms that you listen to your favorite podcast, hopefully it's this one. I'll have Jenny's information in the description below and her contact information. And if you decide to go to my little YouTube page, and I'll have that there too as well. You can watch the interview here too as well. So Jenny, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm just going to close off the podcast here. This has been the Metaphysical Mentor Podcast with Michael Philpott. Thank you so much for joining me, and goodbye for now.